study grows out of some contentions of Heinz Bloom, who wrote the book Martin Luther, Creative Translator. I'm sure you're all familiar with it, and points out the fact that we've got a lot of generalizations about the role of Martin Luther as a Bible translator, and also regarding the relationship of his work to previous versions. But there are not really very many detailed studies of solid portions of Luther's Bible from which such generalizations can really be derived. I think that you find a few of them in Bloom's book. You find some not real comprehensive studies, but rather hop, skip, and jump kind of assumptions in the Deutsche Bibel, Volume 6. Men like Freytag have made some findings with respect to Luther's relationship to the pre-Luther Bibles. But I would agree with Bloom's contention that if a number of people were to make some studies of a more comprehensive nature on taking particular selections from the Luther Bible and collating them with the Erasmus text and the pre-Luther German Bibles, we could then have a real basis for substantiating the relationship among these various texts. And that's what I've tried to do with this study. It certainly, as one would anticipate, corroborates Luther's use of Erasmus' Greek New Testament in doing his work of translation. But I feel that it also turns up some instances where Luther does seem to have been influenced by the earlier translations of the Bible into German. And one thing which I hadn't really looked for, but which came through rather clearly, is that in many cases the Vulgate version, which Luther presumably used, was a good deal closer to the Nestle-Aulen text that we have today than was Erasmus's Greek New Testament. I know that Erasmus' text, everyone agrees, has quite a number of errors introduced, but I was a little bit impressed by the relative accuracy of the text which the Vulgate translators apparently used. Now, the title of the paper is Luther's Translation of Mark 14, verses 1 to 52. And there was no particular reason for the selection of this passage. That is, I didn't select it because I knew there were certain obvious problems or items of interest in it. I felt that would have been foreign to the whole point had I foreseen textual problems or particular points of interest. So the passage was chosen rather at random, aside from the fact that it is an interesting and important portion of the Markan narrative. I wanted to see what was Luther's translation procedure in handling a quite ordinary section of narrative. So to that end, Luther's translation was examined in the light of Erasmus's Greek New Testament, the versions you have at the top of this mimeocheat, and then his Latin translation, the Vulgate, and the pre-Luther German Bibles, in order to see what we could find about Luther's translation technique, whether he translated wholly independently or whether he perhaps did make use of some of the work which previously had been done by his fellow Germans. The 1519 Greek New Testament of Erasmus is the one which was probably used by Luther, although he may have also had access to the 1521 Gerbel edition, which did not include the Erasmian Latin translation. Then I selected a Vulgate text of 1495 as being a fair representative of the Vulgate available to Luther. Probably it would have been preferable had one been able to use the 1509 Basel edition, but I was not able to make use of that at the time I did this. So far as I know, no one has yet determined which of the 14 printed High German pre-Luther vernacular Bibles the Reformer actually used. Wilhelm Kurlmeier, in his compilation The Erste Deutsche Bibel, provides the mental text, which was the first printed German Bible, together with a critical apparatus, which indicates the alterations which were made in the 13 subsequent printed High German Bibles. I've put a chart of the family of German Bibles on the board here so you can see how they grew. This is from Strand, let's see, Kenneth Strand, German Bibles before Luther. So Menthol is the first one, then Eggestein, and then one odd offshoot, Flonsman, and then the rest all follow through Ziner. Ziner 1, A, and B, then Ziner 2, Ziner, and then Zork 2, and Zork 1 as a separate line here, and then this one odd one, Zenzenschmidt-Prisoner, and then following from Ziner 1, this whole series of Koberger, Schainsberger, and two Uttmeyer Bibles. So you've got a whole family tree of pre-Luther German Bibles. Now, since the edition which was printed by Ziner in 1475 was available to Luther, and since the other and subsequent German High or High German Bibles generally followed the Ziner tradition, we use the first edition of Ziner, which was reconstructed from the Menthol Bible with the aid of the notes that Kurlmeier provided. So he's got the Menthol text and then this critical apparatus. So I went through that and with the critical apparatus reconstructed what was the Ziner text. And this then became the exemplar which you have before you on the mimeograph sheets. The alterations in the other High German Bibles were not ignored. At times they become somewhat significant. So far as Luther's own work is concerned, the references are to Benzile's critical edition, which gives the Luther Bible of 1545 together with the critical apparatus for the previous editions. But the apparatus didn't play much of a role in this study really, because there are very few changes in the text of Mark 14 between the September Testament of 1522 and the 1545 edition, which was, of course, the last edition completed under Luther's eye. So these are the versions which you have before you there with a little bit of a key at the top. And what I thought I would do this morning is to work through a verse-by-verse analysis to look at the interrelationship of the texts. You'll notice that not all the verses in this portion are given here, and we're going to have to skip quite a few more as we go along because there won't be time to look at all of them. I'll try as I go along to pick out some texts which I think are of particular interest. Perhaps we could look at verse 2, even though that is not a very interesting one, but it does immediately demonstrate the two lines. Here textually, Luther is following Erasmus's Greek and Latin, as shown by the fact that he does not translate the forte of the Vulgate, which Ziner renders with vielleicht. And so immediately you have the two lines of Vulgate Ziner and Erasmus Luther. I think that's the main point to be noted in this verse. I think it's interesting, though, to note Luther's very free and idiomatic Ja nicht auf das Fest, and also Ziner's very charming translation. I think that if we say that these people were always wooden, I just don't quite believe that this is a very wooden translation of the Vulgate. I'm rather taken by this, wann sie sprachen nicht an dem Messtag, das vielleicht ich werde gemacht wuff in dem Volk. That's not a very wooden rendering at all, I should think. Then in verse 3b, this one I would like to lift out because of a philological problem which I think is of interest, although probably it doesn't yield very much as far as the point of the paper is concerned. And that has to do with the rather confusing Greek term pistikes. Here again, the two lines, Erasmus Luther and Vulgate Ziner, appear. Erasmus translates the Greek word with the comparable Latin term pistikai, and Luther follows that. So faithful, true, unadulterated, Luther follows with ungefälschtem, whereas the Vulgate has the nartis peccati, and Ziner renders that very woodenly, by simply rendering it nartis peccat. And so you've got here two basic terms. One is a two-word term, nardus pisticus, and the other is nardus peccatus. And they both were rather common coin. In nardus pisticus, you've got the adjective pisticus, which was used in conjunction with nardus, meaning probus or fidelis or non adulterinus, pure, and which is related to the Greek pistikos, perhaps derived from piine, something potable. And then, on the other hand, nard is called spicatus. And this is apparently a reference to the heads of the plant. Uguto says, nardus quorum sumitates conveniunt in spigas. Nardus, whose heads come together in a kind of a point, whence it is called stachos, or pointed by the Greeks. And there's a little couplet which pulls together these two terms very neatly, I think. A Latin couplet, nardum spicatum, de spicis, sit tibi factum, nardum spicatus, which is made of, which has points, est is the same thing as nardum pisticum, which is purum, sivi fidele. So here's a basic differentiation, and the two lines, Vulgate Signer and Erasmus Luther, appear on the basis of their rendering this term in these two different ways. In verse 4, we almost have to mention that, not because, again, of its what it does for this the point of my paper, really, so much as the fact that it's a good example of Luther's freedom in translation, where he translates, was soll doch dieser Unrat? What's the idea of this wastefulness? I'm, in turn, translating him freely. This, of course, was the rendering which Luther defended so vigorously in his Zendbrief vom Dolmetschen. But in that Zendbrief, he makes reference, and I think this is an important point, he makes reference to the use of the term verleusung, where he renders was soll doch dieser Unrat? He makes use of the term verleusung. He says, if I were to follow the jackasses and the literalists, the Buchstabelisten, then I would have to translate, warum ist diese Verleusung der Salben geschehen? Now the point is that Verleusung is the term which had been used by Mentel in his Bible, and so quite probably Luther may have had reference to the rather wooden or literalistic translation in his estimation of these earlier High German Bibles at this point. Now in verse 5, I believe that there are traces of a relationship between Luther and the Vulgate Signer. Luther parallels the Vulgate use of unguentum and Signer's use of the word salb, and uses the word Wasser here. But now the point is that neither the Greek nor the Latin versions of Erasmus have any noun. So he has introduced a noun in the same way that the Vulgate and Signer have done that. Now, of course, as is true of a lot of the deductions here, some of it could be coincidental. I think the point is, if we can find enough indications like this, we can start to draw some conclusions. Here's one little thing where Luther is similar to Vulgate and Signer. Another item here is Luther's use of the term Pfennige, which is the same as Signer's term Pfennig, of course, and in fact Freytag, in his analysis in the Weimar Ausgabe of the Deutsche Bibel, pinpoints this as a particular instance of relationship between Luther and the Signer Bible. I'd like to pass by a couple of verses then, and point out in verse 10 the similarity between Luther and Signer, which seems to be more than coincidental. In fact, apart from several words, you'll notice that they read the same. I think, for example, if you would
look at the Greek, hina parado autois, the very last phrase here. You could very nicely have translated that in superatin, but both Sinner and Luther agree syntactically. Das in, Sinner has different word, das in Antwort, and Luther das in ferita. But the syntactical agreement, I think, may well be a significant one. In verse 16, I have not reproduced that, but, or did I? I forget now if I put the Luther, perhaps I put Sinner and Luther in there. But here you see again, you've got an almost exact relationship between Sinner and Luther. Similarly, in verse 18, now, with regard to the text, it should be noted that Sinner adds a tsu-in, which does not occur in the Greek or in any of the other versions. But here the main interest is Luther's similarity to the older German Bibles in the latter half of the verse. The wahrlich sag ich euch, wahrlich ich sage euch, and then particularly what follows, you get the striking parallel to Sinner, and especially if you follow there to the earlier mental Bible. Here syntactically also, the Greek reads, if you would translate it literally, and both Vulgate and Erasmus's Latin follow this, that one of you will betray me who eats with me, whereas Menthol and Luther both recast the clause syntactically, dass einer von euch, der mit mir ist, mich verrat, wird mich verraten. I think the syntactical shift from the Greek to the German here, which is the same in the case of both Menthol and Luther, is of some significance. Perhaps we could look at verses 23 to 24 as a further example. There's an obvious close relationship as you read Luther and the earlier German versions, and particularly in the use of the word testament. And here again, Freytag, in his analysis, sees an echo of the earlier German Bibles there. Now, I'd like to ask you to look at verses 26 and 27 for a somewhat different purpose because of the textual problem which is inherent in these verses. Here, the Nestle-Aland text, I also compared this to these two Nestle-Aland, does not have the expression in Greek, enemoi ente nuktitaute. It doesn't occur in the text or even in the apparatus. But Erasmus uses all of it in his Latin translation, per me in nocte hac, and the Vulgate has in nocte ista, but no per me. And the curious thing is that Sinner agrees with Erasmus here, in mir in der Nacht. And you wonder now, where in the world Sinner got this? Why he didn't follow the Vulgate? And I suppose you might speculate that you could find a clue in the Planaria, in the collections of pericopes, which were used in the Middle Ages. So to me, that was a very curious textual problem. In verse 31, the point, I think, is the various translations of Ek Perisseus, which Erasmus translates very specifically as vehementius, with greater emphasis or force. And the Vulgate renders it as amplius. Sinner follows with Furbas, and Luther is in the Sinner tradition with his Noch weiter. And so I would see in here a similarity between Luther and the Vulgate Sinner tradition rather than the Erasmus. Verse 34 is a striking one, I think, in the resemblance between Luther and Sinner, where the versions are almost identical, except that Sinner adds a mit mir, which does not occur anywhere else, in any of the Greek versions or in the Vulgate, for that matter. And this, of course, raises the question of whether he got it
from the planaria, which were in use in the Middle Ages. I'd like to find one example of the textual superiority of the Vulgate. At, I think this one probably, verses 45 and 46, where first of all you have the divergence of the two lines, Vulgate Signer and Erasmus Luther, very clearly, where the Vulgate has no equivalent for the second auta, which occurs in Erasmus. And so Erasmus translates dikitque ei, and the Vulgate has iit. And here Signer follows the Vulgate und sprach, while Luther follows Erasmus und sprach zu ihm. Again, Erasmus' Greek text, you notice, has rabbi occurring twice. He translates in the Latin rabbi, rabbi, and Luther follows that with rabbi, rabbi, but the Vulgate renders awe rabbi, and Signer translates that idiomatically bis gegrüßet Meister. So he's following Vulgate while Luther is following the Erasmus text. Incidentally, here's a very good example of the early Bible using a very idiomatic rendering. Certainly, Gott grüß dich Meister is anything but a wooden translation into the German here. Now, of course, the question is, where did the Vulgate translation originate here? And it's obviously stemming from a Greek text that was at this point more accurate than that of Erasmus. Nestle Arendt omits the second auto and the second rabbi, and here you have the Vulgate of 1495 in perfect agreement. Another illustration of the accuracy of the Vulgate is in verse 47 with another textual curiosity. Here the Nestle Aland text reads, Eistetiston pares tekaton. Now, Erasmus' Greek text omits the tis, but that term shows up both in his own Latin translation, unus autem quispiam, and also in the Vulgate, unus autem quidam. And this would seem to indicate, since the Vulgate is obviously translating tis, that it is following a Greek text that by modern standards was superior to that of Erasmus. Erasmus, in turn, might have gotten his translation from the Vulgate, not following his own Greek text, I suppose, although he shifts from quidam here to quispiam. Another point here would be the similarity between Signer and Luther in the phrase "un heap ihm up ein Ohr," where Luther has "un heap ihm ein Ohr up." It seems to me they are extremely close at this point. Finally, verses 50 to 52, the final one. Here you've got considerable differences in the renderings of the first verse, and here Luther follows the Vulgate and Signer. The Vulgate specifies who fled, the discipuli eius. That phrase does not occur either in Erasmus' Latin text or in the Greek equivalent in his Greek text. Signer follows the Vulgate with de junger, but he omits translating the eius. And Luther, just like Signer, renders it as de junger. And so I think we could assert that at least quite probably here is Luther is following a Vulgate Signer tradition rather than the texts of Erasmus. Well, these are some samples lifted out of here to illustrate the points. I think I've hit examples of all three things where you've got Luther ordinarily following Erasmus, but it seems to me that one could fairly conclude at least a high probability of Luther's familiarity with the Mentelt-Signer tradition and possibly making use of it
from time to time. Now, whether he just knew it, or whether he had an exemplar before him, which I would not think would be out of the question at all, certainly there are some rather striking similarities in my estimation. And then I think we've also illustrated the fact that at certain points, where the Erasmus text is obviously different than the text which the Vulgate follows, the Vulgate seems to be following a text which is very close to the modern Nestle-Aland text, again demonstrating the essential accuracy of the Vulgate for this particular passage, at any rate. I realize that this is a very minute kind of study, but I think probably that a number of studies like this might be pulled together eventually to form a ground for a pretty good study of the interrelationships of these texts.
Just wait for a question.
Okay. Yes, sir.
How do you get access to the designer text?
Well, I got that is the Kurlmeier, no, the Binzeil Niemeyer. The title is Dr. Martin Luther's Bibelübersetzung nach der letzten Originalausgabe. Dr. Martin Luther's Bibelübersetzung nach der letzten Originalausgabe, published in Halle, 1845-55, in 7 volumes. And I got access to this in the Duke University Rare Book Room. They have all of this here. This is where I did this work, actually. They've got the Kurlmeier edition of the early German Bibles, and then they've got this Binzeil Niemeyer. They had the 1495 Vulgate. They had all the Erasmus texts were there. So it's a wonderful place to play around with this kind of thing. It's a delightful surrounding and a kind of a Tudor library, and you just pull all the books together there, and yeah, it's really fun to work there. Yeah. Right.
No, that I can say. But it is in the Rare Book Room itself rather than in the library. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
This little paper is a brief report on some work that I was able to begin about 2 years ago, dealing with Luther's treatment of the sacraments in the years 1518 and 1519, obviously years of considerable, great importance for the genesis of the Reformation. I do find a definite phase in Luther's work on the sacraments in these this two-year span, a phase beginning in the lectures on Hebrews in 1517 and then extending through the three treatises of autumn 1519, treatises on penance, baptism, and the Blessed Sacrament and the Brotherhood. I would see an end that can be obviously not completely a stopping point, but an end of a phase that can be singled out, an end that's signaled by Luther's letter to Spalatin in December 18th of 1519, in which he tells Spalatin that his series on the sacraments, which has grown to three treatises, that the series will not be completed, will not go any further, because he's come to see that in the absence of an express divine promise, there is no sacrament. This from December of 1519. And so at this time, promissio is not only to the fore, but it has become normative as the main constitutive element in a sacrament, which of course is the case in the works of 1520 on the New Testament and in the Babylonian captivity. And of course, at this time in late 1519, the question of how many sacraments comes to the fore. And again, the promissio is normative in the argument that develops. But I'd like today to go back 2 years earlier to examine how Luther explained the sacramental forgiveness of sin in the year 1518. In the wake of the 95 Theses, we do find him quite frequently explaining sacramental forgiveness at the different levels on which he did operate. He talks to his students, to the people at large in sermons and publications, and to his fellow theologians in the Disputation and in the Resoluciones. I'd like to single out today just one small aspect of this work on sacrament and forgiveness in 1518, a quite remarkable insistence on Matthew chapter 16, verse 19, as the basis, as foundational for sacramental forgiveness. I give you that text as I can reconstruct it from Luther's own citation of it at the top of the page from the Vulgate. The promise of the keys for binding and loosing. I would suggest that we have here one important prototype for the divine promise that will come to the fore quite explicitly, linked, as we heard yesterday from Ken Hagen, with testamentum and pactum as being very central in his understanding of the sacraments. I think even a brief reflection this morning of some texts here where he's citing Matthew 16:19 will indicate that this verse has considerable importance, both in the genesis of the Reformation, because of the role it played at the Augsburg confrontation with Cajetan, and as well, it has a role in what I would call a gradual shift in Luther's thought, moving away from the repeated use of paradox in interpreting the Word of God, which is, I think, a hallmark of the earlier Theologia Crucis, to a more mature focus on the gospel as an openly, explicitly proclaimed word of forgiveness. This is a shift that has been noted in recent works, one by Matthias Kroger, Vertikalens Gesetz, a Göttingen dissertation of 1968, and then most recently by Ian Siggins, in his Martin Luther's Doctrine of Christ, just off from Yale University Press.
Would you repeat the last reference?
Siggins, Martin Luther's Doctrine of Christ, Yale, 1970. Therefore, to a few texts from 1518. The first one is from the Resolutio that Luther wrote for the seventh of the 95 Theses. In the original thesis from October of 1517, Luther had merely asserted the obligation that one has to confess his sins in the sacrament of penance. And then these lines, taken from the Resolutio or explanation, Luther is facing the problem how the priest's absolution in the confessional actually functions in view of the fact that at times there is forgiveness of sin and there is justification, under the contrary, prior to confession. Why then the obligation still to come to confession to receive the absolution? And Luther's response is that the words of absolution bring certitude about forgiveness. They bring consolation, peace of heart. They bring the dissipation of any doubt. Let's take a look at the text and note especially what the ultimate reason or ground for this is. Here I'll translate somewhat less than perfectly literally, from the first extended citation of Luther on the mimeograph page. One being absolved must take great care never to doubt that his sins are forgiven before God. And he must be at peace in his heart. He is obliged to accept the judgment of another not because of the other's office as prelate, nor in any way because of his power, but because of the word spoken by Christ, who cannot deceive, whatever you loose on earth. Faith in this word brings peace of conscience when the priest absolves in accord with it. You will have just as much peace as you have faith in this word of the one who promises, whatever you loose, and so on. For Christ is our peace, but in faith. And then a few lines further down. Thus, as a general rule, we are not certain of the forgiveness of guilt except by the judgment of the priest. And in fact, not even through this, unless you believe Christ when he promised, whatever you loose. But as long as we are not certain, this is not really forgiveness, since it is not yet our forgiveness. Nondum nobis. In fact, one is lost in a worse way unless forgiveness becomes certain, because one does not believe that there is forgiveness to be in his case, in one's own case. I don't think we need to read further to grasp the gist of Luther's argument. Peace of conscience is attained, or perhaps better, received, through faith which grasps a definite word of Christ, the promise of Matthew 16:19. Practically speaking, the word of absolution spoken by the confessor coalesces with the original promise, the promise in virtue of which the absolution is effective, and in fact, in virtue of which the absolution is believed. Because both of these words, the absolution, the promise, the gospel, are definite, free of any ambiguity or paradox, I feel we must speak of some kind of breakthrough, obviously one among many for Luther, but some kind of breakthrough in connection with this case, with this text. Because here, the paradoxical scheme of the absconditum sub contrario, hiddenness beneath contrary appearance, sub contraria specie, does not apply to God's word. Forgiveness is not hidden beneath a word of condemnation or a word of judgment, as was the case in the lectures on Romans, where Luther was working with the duality of judicium and justitia, and speaking of the word of forgiveness under a word of accusation. Here there is a clear word that conveys peace, a peace one is to accept in faith. Let me now make some very brief comments on certain parallel uses of the Matthew 16:19, which occur in the same time span, very early 1518. I've listed them there in the center of the paper. First, the Resolutio of Thesis 38. In this text, Luther gives an explanation of how one can actually believe the high dignity and the sublime gifts that God gives to those who become associated with Christ in faith. In Scripture, it states that the just, those associated with Christ, share much with Christ, that they become heirs of the kingdom, sons of God, sharers in the divine nature. Luther lists these New Testament titles. But then he poses the problem, how can one actually believe in all this? As he says, the sensus peccati is so strong to overcome one's faith in such sublime gifts. But here the keys play their part. For in the word of the promise, Matthew 16, you have something outside yourself to hold to, a ground, a propter quod, for believing that you do share in the treasures of Christ's grace. The second text paralleling the seventh resolution is a sermon given on the Feast of the Purification, therefore on February 2nd, and most probably in 1518, although the dating is not beyond all discussion. There is a reference in the sermon to indulgences, which would urge that it should be dated near to October, late 1517. And then there is the stress on belief in the word of absolution as the way to true purification, which would, I would think, perhaps confirm the 1518 dating of the sermon by tying it rather closely to the Resolutiones. The context in the sermon is very briefly Luther's presentation of a way to true purification from sin, which he explains as being through confession of sin and through firm belief in the words of absolution. Speaking of the priest's words of absolution, spoken in the confessional, Luther can add immediately, and rather, and moreover, the words of Christ as being what is believed. Christ who promised, whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. However it might be with one's sorrow for sin, purification comes through being utterly convinced, persuasissimum, that Christ's promise is valid and is in fact applied through the absolution. Third parallel text would be a sermon on the priesthood, again probably given in 1518, most likely at the first Mass of a newly ordained priest. In the midst of his sermon, Luther poses the rhetorical question, why is it that priests are held in honor? His response is, not because of their vestments, what they wear, not because of their gestures, but rather because of their tongues. Their tongues are the claves regni caelorum, the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And they are this, Luther explains, when they speak words of absolution, peace, and consolation, and confession. And of course, the basis is, again cited, Matthew 16:19. Incidentally, in this sermon on the priesthood, Luther drops a hint that he has not always so understood this verse of the first gospel, has not always seen it as the clear ground of forgiveness and peace. Says, somewhat as an aside, this text disturbed my mind for a long time. Towards it, diu, animum meum hic auctoritas. However, one can conjecture that there must have been at some time a moment of peace, a moment of some light, as Luther came to realize what the text should mean to the troubled conscience seeking forgiveness and assurance. Fourth parallel text to the seventh resolutio is the Salmo de Penitentia, which is actually a presentation in essay form, quite systematic, of the main doctrinal and practical points concerning the sacrament of penance. And in the final section, we find Luther being quite concerned that one look away from his own fears, his own sorrows or regrets, and come to rely solely upon the word of Christ to Peter, a word that stands behind and echoes through the priest's absolution. The ceremony ends with a rousing exhortation to belief in the efficacy of the absolution. Crede fortiter te absolutum. Any doubt here would impugn the veracity of Christ, so Luther argues, and the sufficiency of faith for justification. In the context of the university and academic life, there's a fifth parallel text, where because Luther chose the topic of sacramental forgiveness as a disputation topic in spring of 1518, again indicating his concern, his interest in the subject. As an ordinarius of the faculty, he was able to choose the topics to be disputed by the theses, by these students, and we have the theses then under the intriguing title Disputatio de Veritate Inquirenda et Timoratis Conscientius Consolandis in Volume 1 of the Weimar. This is especially valuable because of the terseness and compact character of the thesis form. It allows one to see quite clearly the skeleton of Luther's argument, which again is about the basis, foundation, the ground of forgiveness. And again, it is twice cited, Matthew 16:19. These 50 theses are doubly interesting because of a small flourish that Luther added at the end. After the final, the 50th thesis, he felt he could sum it all up in what he called a summa summarium, and that was namely the simple statement, the righteous does not live by works or by the law, sed ex fide vivit, Romans 1:17b. This little flourish at the end echoes another text, of course, great interest in studying Luther's development. However, I would just want to point out here that in this citation of it, the context is quite clear. It is that of a debate about the sacraments. And in fact, in the course of the theses, Luther has repeatedly spoken of fides as fides sacramenti, a faith that grasps the sacramental word, faith grounded in the promise of Christ in Matthew 16:19. Lastly, a few words about the Acta Augustana from late 1518. By midsummer, it's clear that Cajetan had received some of the writings that we've treated, and it's can be proven that he had on his desk in Augsburg in late September of 1518 the Resolutiones, the Sermo de Penitentia, and perhaps some other works of Luther. And so when Luther appeared before him in their October meeting, he was able to raise a quite specific objection against Luther's notion of fides sacramenti. And now, hidden among Cajetan's opuscula, we have a short treatise that he wrote 3 weeks before he met Luther, written on the 26th of September, 1518. He met Luther in mid-October, probably 14th, 15th, and 16th. In the opusculum, or the quaestio that he wrote, he cites Luther quite precisely, but then develops an argument that I would sum up under three heads. His argument is that Luther's conception, as we've seen it here developing, at least from one perspective, Luther's conception is first contrary to the implicit or lived convictions of the faithful, in oppositum est communis ecclesiae sensus. Secondly, Luther stresses a certitude that in effect relativizes the importance of contrition, of sorrow grounded in love. And thirdly, that Luther features in fact a certitude that is not attainable in the sacraments because of the interpersonal, the communal, or mediated character of the sacramental encounter, which brings an element of obscurity or density, lack of complete transparency, somewhat modernized presentation perhaps of Cajetan's argument. We know that in the meeting, Luther gave an immediate oral response to Cajetan's criticism, and this brought on a rather stormy exchange, an exchange that has quite fascinated the biographers of Luther and the expositors of his thought, the clash of personalities since that day. But we know Luther also submitted a written defense, the substance of which came out in the Acta Augustana in the following month, in November. This response involves a rather quite impressive barrage of biblical texts on salvation by faith. And they lead up to what I believe is Luther's first appeal to his conscience. He says a conscience that is convinced and held captive by the biblical texts he has amassed, and so he begs the cardinal not to ask him to go against his conscience in the demand for recantation. But near the top of Luther's list of texts, we see a most emphatic use of Matthew 16:19. Again, I'll translate some sections here from the little excerpt of the Acta Augustana. Luther states his thesis. I must prove that one approaching the sacrament must believe that he receives grace. He must not doubt this, but must have utter trust. Excuse the typographical error, fiducia is important. but there's only one fiducia in the text. He must have utter trust, or else he approaches and meets condemnation. And then Luther gives as a first text, Hebrews 11:6, one approaching God must believe that he exists and rewards those seeking him. I would surmise that this first text came into Luther's mind because of the verbal tie, the word accidentem, featured in the Hebrews text, echoes the accessuro of the thesis immediately before to be proven the issue at hand. But then let's look at his second argument. Under pain of eternal damnation, being guilty of unbelief, one must believe these words of Christ: whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Therefore, if you approach the sacrament of penance and do not firmly believe you are absolved in heaven, you approach, in fact, judgment and condemnation. Because you do not believe that Christ spoke the truth when he said, whatever you loose, and so on. By your doubt, you make Christ out as a liar, which is a frightful sin. Again, I think the nub of Luther's argument is what we saw above, how the promise contained in this verse of the first gospel is to be the ground of a firm conviction that the sacrament here and now mediates forgiveness. Twice in the Acta Augustana and further section, Luther spoke of the need of fides de effectu presenti, faith about a here and now effect. Historically, perhaps, the most notable point would be the rather high pitch of Luther's argumentation here, with his threat of damnation, denial of Christ, if one does not believe in this way. We know from Luther's letters that he was quite shocked, hurt, by Cajetan's objection. It came as a surprise, echoes something, the situation at Worms. On October the 14th, 1518, one of the days in which he actually met with Cajetan, we have a letter written to Karlstadt with a rather bleak mood, in which Luther says that Cajetan is treating him most ineptly, in fact asking recantation of the very point through which Luther became a Christian. Den Artikel durch welchen ich ein Christ geworden. In November of 1518, a month later, Luther wrote to the Prince Elector Friedrich and lamented that fides sacramenti is all but unknown among the people. And then in December, Luther sent out copies of the Acta Augustana to his friends, and in the covering letter to Wenceslaus Link, letter 121 in the first volume of the Briefwechsel, Luther speaks for the first time of the Antichrist foretold by Paul, when he surmises is now reigning in the Roman Curia. These letters serve to highlight the fact that Cajetan had touched on a sensitive nerve, a very serious point in Luther's understanding of his teaching up to that time. I think it's obvious that careful study of Cajetan's objection would be rewarding, perhaps doubly so in view of the way it's been treated in a recent book by Gerhard Penny, Cajetan und Luther, Stuttgart, 1965. I really don't feel that Hennig has come very close to the argumentation that Cajetan was actually proposing. But my attention today is much more upon Luther, especially upon this first phase of his work on sacramental forgiveness. I think it's clear we find him using Matthew 16:19 as a very important biblical basis, and therefore there's a real element of the tradition in his argument. It's obvious that he was at the same time using other texts, but this promise of the keys for binding and loosing seems to me to have allowed him to speak with perhaps a new clarity, freed from all paradox precisely about how the Word of God is addressed to the human conscience. I would suggest, without trying to be overly dramatic using the word breakthrough, that we have here one important step, one step among many, along Luther's path to his theological maturity as spokesman for the gospel of forgiveness. A gospel, however, that is to be received in faith, faith here defined quite specifically as fides sacramenti. Let me make as somewhat of an appendix two remarks, bring up two sort of historiographical issues. In view of what we've seen here, in spite of its brevity, I think I would have to say that the common charge leveled by Catholic historians, notably Joseph Lortz, about Luther's fatally subjectivistic orientation method needs, I think, some significant modification, restriction, or revision. The term subjectivism would be most inappropriate for characterizing the theology of forgiveness, of fides sacramenti, that we've seen in these 1518 texts. This faith is rather eccentric, to use the term of Wilfried Joest, for above all, it wants to move away from the subject, from the believer. It wants to be objectivistic, fixing upon a word, a promise once given, that's quite impervious to any manipulation. It is rather the objectivity of the sacraments that characterizes Luther's dominant concern, or one of his dominant concerns, in these years that are something, serve as something of a hinge for the beginning for the Reformation. A second remark would point, perhaps somewhat indirectly, towards some misgivings that I myself personally would have about the conception that Luther is presenting. I simply would put it this way. I would hope that Cajetan's critique, Cajetan's objection, and the argumentation that he developed at great length in the Opusculum that I referred to would not be neglected any longer, and certainly not be rejected out of hand, seeing that Cajetan is a Thomist, an Italian, a Curialist, all those horrible things. Now, I'm not suggesting that Cajetan's argument is flawless, whose is, but it is, I think, a minor scandal that it's practically unknown in Luther biographies, practically unknown in expositions of Luther's intellectual development. It's in the Opuscula there to be found. Cajetan was, above all, a shrewd and alert reader of Luther's early work. He seemed to see very serious consequences in the conception of forgiveness that Luther was presenting. In the midst of the Opusculum, or the Quaestio, he has the sentence that is quite uncanny. Insight for late September of 1518, hoc est novam construere ecclesiam. This is 3 weeks before he actually met Luther, 3 weeks before the course of events began to roll in precisely that direction. This insight of Cajetan's nicely echoes Luther's own words in those letters at the time of the Augsburg meeting, and highlights again the great importance of Luther's view of sacramental forgiveness here in these very first years of Reformation controversy.